Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Here in the Northern Rockies, dark winter months are outlasted in basements, dens, and nooks where kindred souls gather together to share intel, swap fly patterns, and relive the memories from seasons past. This gathering spot, known locally as the February Room, is the inspiration for this podcast. No matter the season, the door is always open to those with a fly fishing story to tell. Brought to you by CD Fishing USA, the North American distributor for composite development fly rods and accessories. 40 years of Kiwi ingenuity and graphite technology now available at cd-fishing.us or your local CD USA dealer. Follow us on Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook. And remember to go fishing. Here's your host, the Carnops, and this is the February Room.
Welcome to the February Room. Lauren Carnop here. Enjoyed last week's episode? Incredible what Woosh Innovations are doing to solve the fish passage problem. If you did enjoy last week's podcast or any episode prior, please remember to rate, review, and subscribe to our podcast. Thank you for your support. We all have that buddy at the campfire who has a lifetime filled with adventures and a life experience that makes you think, holy shit, you've done a lot. And might have you thinking in the back of your mind, how in the world are you still here? Well, lucky for you, you don't have to deal with a spam dinner to hear some incredible stories because I've got you covered. Welcome my next guest, Tim Quinton. Thank you so much for joining me today, Tim.
You're welcome, Lauren. It's my pleasure to be here.
Well, I'm so excited because like I said, Justin has, doing a little background, you have really a life experience with so much adventure. And as always, we kick the podcast with a fishing story and I can't wait to hear what yours is.
Yeah. So, like I mentioned before, Justin's a great, good guide and a good guy. So, you know, it's a pleasure to fish.
He's a double G's.
Yeah, he's a 2G kind of guy. But and I've got a good story about him later that I'll share with you. But for right now, my first fishy story is kind of a follow on and some back story about what another one of your guests a few months back, I think it was about 6 months ago, Kay talked about.
Lightning on the water.
Lightning on the water, yeah. So Ron and I were fishing that day together at Hosmer Lake, and the call of nature struck me, and I had to row myself back to the campground area. And luckily, it wasn't too far away. So I get back to the campground area on the boat ramp, and I walk up to the little outhouse. Anybody who's been to Hosmer knows exactly where I'm talking about. There's a Hosmer outhouse, just a little bit walk, you know, maybe 7,500 yards up the hill from the boat launch. So I'm in there and I did my business, and all of a sudden, I hear this huge crash, and it sounded like someone dropped a school bus on top of the outhouse. It was huge. So I come out and I walk back down to the boat ramp and I'm looking around. There's four or five people standing around there. And I said, geez, that sounded really close. So they said, yeah, man, it hit right over there. Right to where Ron and I were fishing. So I said, wow, my buddy's over there, you know.
I hope my buddy's still there.
Well, yeah, that's exactly right. So a few seconds later, I see this rooster tail coming back across the lake right at me. Which a rooster tail, if you're not familiar with boat talk, rooster tail's a big, like, it looks like the tail of a rooster shooting out of the back of the boat because it's going really fast, right? So yes. Ron, I've never seen him row so fast in my life. So he's rowing really fast toward, he gets over the boat ramp. He goes, man, I almost got hit by lightning. It was one of those things that, thank goodness, we can laugh about it now. I'm sure he was scared to death because he started talking about, you know, he saw blue light all around him. He could feel, you know, the oars, you know, vibrating, and he could feel electricity in the air and everything. And he said he expected his boat to blow up any minute. I mean, I'm kind of saying the same thing he said in the podcast, but that was amazing.
I think what's so crazy about that whole, I mean, especially with your point of view, is that that small decision to get off the water. I mean, if things had gone south, I mean, small decisions can result in big life changes. So now every time you see a storm coming, do you have second guesses if you're going to go out there?
Oh, no. No.
It hasn't stopped you. You're like, I've done this before.
I'm still as dumb as ever. Yeah, no. And it wasn't a, quote, decision to get off the water. It was, you know, you better get off the water or you're going to be, you know, you're going to have an accident here. So it was one of those.
It seems to me, though, that Ron's like, I'm never going to go out if it's stormy or cloudy. Like that one, it seemed like that experience really shook him up indefinitely.
Yeah, it probably did. And, you know, like you're exactly right. If I hadn't come back in, who knows? Maybe I had been over closer to where the lightning hit and something bad could have happened.
So. I know. It's just those small decisions can, you know, have bigger effects. Well, and like I said, as we kind of started this podcast, you have an incredible background in your life. And I was hoping that you can tell us a little bit about how your life and fly fishing kind of comes together, how it intertwines.
Sure. Yeah. No, I grew up on the East Coast in, you know, a bunch of states, actually, New York, New Jersey, Maryland, Virginia, went to college in Connecticut, started fly fishing when I was about 14. So this is just finishing up my 54th year of fly fishing. It sounds like a long time, but boy, it flies.
It does.
Yeah. So I started actually in New Jersey of all places, in the Pine Barrens. We lived in Lakehurst, which is kind of right in the middle of the state. And we lived right next to the Naval Air Station there where the Hindenburg crashed in the 30s, if you're a history buff. And I started fly fishing there, and luckily there was a guy who took pity on me in my first year fly fishing as I was beating the water to a froth and not casting very well. He said, hey, let the cast straighten out a little bit more behind you before you start the forward cast.
Yes.
And that was, you know, it's like, oh, wow, yeah, it's a lot better that way. And as a, you know, I guided for 9 years here in Oregon, and that little bit of advice I've given to many, many people who were struggling with their casting. So that was when I was a 14-year-old kid. So, I mean, that stuck with me. But anyway, yeah, I went to college in Connecticut, and Connecticut has actually some really nice fly fishing water up in the northern part of the state, mostly northwestern. And I fished some of the really nice rivers up there, the Housatonic, the Farmington, the Salmon, a few other rivers. And then I went to the Coast Guard Academy in New London, Connecticut. When I graduated from there, I started going all over the country in the Coast Guard. And I was stationed in Kodiak, Alaska, three different times on three different ships there. And Kodiak is an amazing place for outdoor hunting, fishing, skiing, you know, cross-country type skiing. And as a matter of fact, I caught so many salmon up there, I really don't need to catch salmon anymore.
You got your fill.
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, and I'll freely admit it, I got spoiled on salmon up there. So I just don't fish for salmon all that much. My travels in the Coast Guard took me to, like I said, Kodiak, Alaska, Governor's Island, New York, where I would drive up and fish the Beaver Kill River in upstate New York, which was an amazing river. This is back in the late 70s, early 80s. I think it's still a pretty decent fly fishing river. Seattle, I was stationed in Seattle twice, and I fished a lot around there. The Oregon coast, I fished out there. And that's where we got to know Central Oregon. When we were living on the coast, I used to come over here for good fly fishing and for a little bit of sun. And it was nice. My wife and I first got married when we were stationed there. And yeah, she liked it over here too. So it's one of the reasons we've kind of settled out here.
Which is in Redmond, correct?
Well, actually, this is our third try of settling in Central Oregon.
Third time is a charm.
Yeah. So here's the timeline. June of 2000, I retire from the Coast Guard. We moved to Bend because at the time I was living in Seattle. I had just left. I was executive officer on a ship up there and got transferred or retired. We figured, well, we kind of like Central Oregon. Let's give it a try. So we moved to Bend. We were here for 2 years. We lived down in the southwestern side, kind of just to the west of Fred Meyer on the other side of where the parkway is now, which it wasn't there then. And then we moved after 2 years. So 2000, the next year, 9/11 happens. And The Coast Guard grew bigger, faster, and they didn't have enough people. So they sent out a message that said, any of you old retired farts want to come back on active duty?
Wow. And I said,
so I went back in and I was stationed at the Pentagon for 3 years, which was an incredible experience. You know, I was one of 12 Coasties at the Pentagon, and there's 25,000 people that work in that building every day. So we were the smallest minority at the Pentagon.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a huge building. It really is. you know, like 17 and a half miles of hallways in the building. I mean, that's how big it is. So when I re-retired from the Coast Guard at the end of 05, we said, well, we want to move back to Central Oregon. And we looked around, couldn't find a place that we really liked in Bend. So we found a place that we really liked in Sisters. And we lived in Sisters for 3 years.
So beautiful.
Yeah, it is. Gorgeous place. And we, at the kind of almost at the end of that 3 years, a good friend of mine, an academy classmate of mine, was working for the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory in Richland, Washington, Southeast Washington. And he said, he was talking about all the cool stuff he did working there. And I said, you know, I wouldn't mind doing that. He goes, well, geez, okay. So I sent him a resume. We got hired on. I worked there for 7 years and then retired out of there at the end of 15. And we moved down here. We lived in Eagle Crest, which is kind of a little bit west on the west side of Redmond there. And we had a house built here and we like it here. So
what skills do you think there were skills that you learned in the Coast Guard that was able to that you were able to use as a fishing guide, things that you learned from the Coast Guard that were able to apply as a guide on the Deschutes?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. It wasn't so much fishing because, you know, I've been fishing for a long time before I became a guide. So it was more instructing people and kind of working with people and just learning to listen to them and kind of tailoring what they need to what your guiding style is like.
Well, I'm sure you also have like better way of directing people and like perfecting skills and flies. I do want to, do you have a crazy Coast Guard story? I imagine having that much time spending your career in as a Coast Guard, you must have a pretty incredible story to share.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I got a bazillion of them, of course, but it always seemed like when my ship was on patrol, we didn't get the big, big search and rescue cases where we, you know, saved a bunch of lives or pulled a ship off the rocks or anything like that.
No Titanic stories?
Yeah. No Titanic story. However, here's an interesting one. I was my first tour of duty in Kodiak. I was a junior officer on the ship, and I was one of the boarding officers. I did, in those 2 years I was on that ship, I did probably 100 boardings of foreign fishing vessels up in the Bering Sea. We got on board this one ship. I distinctly remember it was a Taiwanese vessel, the Haile 301. That was the name of it, Haile 301. And we got on board, and the weather was a little iffy because the weather's usually, you know, not great in Bering Sea. And we were about 100 miles west of the Pribilof Islands, so right smack dab in the middle of the Bering. And we got on board, did a boarding. and what we do is we check all their fishing logs and go through their freezer holds to make sure they don't have the wrong kind of fish or that they are reporting their fish correctly. And it was, you know, all federal laws that they had to follow at that time. It's all changed now for that. But anyway, in the 4 hours it took us to do the boarding, the wind and seas really kicked up. So they could not launch the small boat off our ship to come back and pick us up. So basically, our captain talked to the captain on the other, on the Highly 301 where I was, and said, okay, we need you to head toward the Pribilofs. And it was only 100 miles away, which isn't that far. It took us 44 hours to get there. And if you do the math, that's like, you know, a little less than 2 miles an hour, a little more.
Oh my gosh. Cause it was, the weather was that bad.
Yeah. We were looking at the anemometers on the ship and everything. And the wind got out well over 100 knots and the seas, we estimated the seas at probably 50 to 60 feet. So it was pretty good sized seas out there. And we finally got there. And the only thing, so, you know, it was rough. It was nasty outside, you know, storming, blowing, you can hardly see anything. At one point, our ship behind us, it was the Storus, which is no longer in service. They're actually not making way forwards. They're making way backwards.
Oh, no.
But the fishing vessel I was on was a little bit bigger than they were. We could, it was a little bit more comfortable ride, and we did okay. But still, it was interesting. I wasn't really scared, but it was really interesting being out in that huge sea and winds just whipping all over the place. For a 24-year-old guy, it was pretty fun, actually.
You know, it's crazy that I would get seasick. I actually have gotten seasick. I think it was in Boston and my mom was like, we're going to go whale watching. And I went with my cousin and I was like, this is great. This is beautiful. And then 15 minutes later, I was laying on the on the bow of the boat, just like closing my eyes. And I can still remember the outfit I was wearing. I was so miserable. And I feel if I was in that position, I'd probably be in tears crying. I have to say, I'm just totally not. I had to see some land. I don't know why. It just makes me, or maybe I need to take some medication that makes me a little bit better to be out in the sea. I know when I heard you talk about the Bering Sea, it made me think of like Deadliest Catch. A lot of crab fishermen have to deal with a lot of crabbers who've gotten stuck, or like as your position, you said you didn't really save people. So like, what was your main job out on the ocean?
Well, yeah, our main job was if people get in, you know, a tough spot, we would go save them. And I don't mean to sound that we've never done anything. We just, not the big high profile search and rescue.
I see. Okay. So you're still out there as Superman, just not, it wasn't as big scale as.
Yeah. We towed in plenty of boats and we did medevacs off of boats, you know, people that had hurt themselves or were sick, you know, we'd bring them into a port, things like that.
Whale watchers.
Yeah. Yeah. And don't feel bad about getting seasick. Jeez, I got seasick all the time. My first couple of tours at sea. It calmed down after that quite a bit, but yeah, you just kind of get seasick and then you plod on and do your job. You know, that's pretty much it. It's just a fact of life. Some people get seasick.
What was like one of the most common mistakes that you see people doing out in the ocean that you're like, that is the one mistake you should never do, or that you should prepare yourself when you're going to go explore the Bering Sea?
Well, most of the vessels that we came in contact were commercial fishermen. You know, whether it was foreigners or U.S. domestic guys. And most of them are pretty good about preparing. They don't always make the best decisions. I remember there was there were two sister ships. There were crabbers that back in the 90s, I want to say, they both capsized and sank with total loss of life. I don't think they even found anything off them. And that was a bad decision to go out in that sea state, because when you think of a crab boat, when they don't have all their crab pots in the water, okay, you have them all stacked up on deck and it's pretty high. Well, just the weight of the crab pots alone isn't enough to capsize the boat. But when you get out in really bad seas where you're taking a lot of spray over the bow and it's below freezing, so all that spray, since it hits that cold metal, it freezes. Then you start accumulating a lot of topside weight. And that is what causes it capsizes. Because you've got many, many tons of weight above your waterline where you didn't have it before, and that causes you to capsize. So things like that, you know, or sometimes it was just something that nobody had any idea about. You know, something would break on the ship and it would start flooding. And whether it was good maintenance or whether it was just the luck of the draw, you know, that would happen too. Every once in a while, there'd be a collision or someone would break down and we would go and tow them in either to Dutch Harbor or up to the Pribilofs if they were up in that neck of the woods. But generally speaking, it was pretty boring out there a lot of times.
Which boring could be sometimes really good. It's funny because you're saying all these things like the Bering Sea and the port that you were just talking about, because I was such a huge, in the very beginning, I was a huge Deadliest Catch fan. And then I think after season 4, I was like, okay, I think I've got it down. I've got it dialed in what's going to happen. I mean, I think at the very end, I'd just like to see who ended up winning the amount of crabs that they caught. Yeah. But what you described about the ice being on the crab cages, like there was one episode, I think, where they were all scrambling to try and, you know, knock the ice off because it was so heavy.
Yeah.
Did you know a lot of the boats or actually do you recognize a lot of the boats that are on there? Where you're like, oh, I know who's the top guy on there. Like, do you feel like you have the inside knowledge of actually of who these people are?
You know, I have watched Deadliest Catch and it's an interesting show. You know, it's somewhat scripted, I'm sure, but
yes,
you know, whenever you put a microphone and a camera in somebody's face, they're going to act a little bit differently than they do normally. Right.
Right.
But I have seen almost every one of those ships and been aboard quite a few of them. I don't recognize the people. Now, maybe I did meet some of the captains or, you know, cause the crews change a lot and sometimes change quickly too, but I've been aboard on most of them and I've seen a lot of them, and you know, it's a tribute to those guys that they're still here, you know?
Right.
Because it is the Deadliest Catch. I mean, it's the most dangerous job in America anyway, maybe the world. Anytime.
And also the worst health. I mean, those people are the most unhealthiest people. I mean, they seem like they're drinking coffee and smoking cigarettes 24/7. Yeah. I mean, every year you're just like, that is probably, I mean, as a Coast Guard, is the lifestyle the same? Are you smoking cigarettes and drinking coffee 24/7?
Well, you know, when I, on my first couple of ships, we had guys on there who smoked and drank coffee. That was pretty much their whole day, you know? We're in the minority, you know, but, and I never smoked and I never drank coffee. Well, I drank a little bit, but hardly any, and which is weird for the house to see, you know, and most of the people drink coffee like they don't have time.
I still do that. I'm like, 3 cups a day, Lauren, that's all you get, yeah. 3 cups a day.
Yeah, but I can see that. I saw that in a lot of our own guys. And I say guys because we didn't really have to start having women on ships until my second tour. And then we only had 2 officers. They worked for me, really officers. They went on and did fine in their careers, but mostly guys, you know, that was it. And you know, now the last ship I was on the Coast Guard was Coast Guard Cutter Midget, which is no longer in service, out of Seattle, a 378-foot high endurance cutter, and we had a mixed crew, men and women. We did a battle group deployment with a Navy battle group over to the Persian Gulf in 1999. I was the executive officer in there, and that was a great trip. I was that was probably my best 6 months in the whole Coast Guard. We got to see a lot of foreign ports. We got to work with the Navy a lot. The crew did so good. I was so proud of them. They were just super the whole time.
Is that what made it so special? Was the crew, or is it just kind of exploring all these new areas?
Well, it was a combination. The crew made it. Yeah. Made it to where you weren't dreading each day, you know.
Right, right.
The job, and they were just maintaining a great morale, and it just worked out perfect. And then we were able to go all these nice places and enjoy them without. Every once in a while, the life of the XO gets kind of difficult when you have people that are causing trouble. So,
when your space is really limited, you can't. Like if you're like, okay, I do not like this person, you're kind of stuck in the same space with them for quite a while. You're like, okay, well, I guess we're all in the same boat, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
I imagine though, that kind of patience and tolerance and like working with other people must really translated really well as a fishing guide. Cause sometimes, you know, as a guide, not that it happens. I mean, you're in it because you love taking people fishing. You like them experience having this best experience on the water, but sometimes it doesn't go according to plan because maybe the person who's angling doesn't like the weather conditions, doesn't like the fact that they're not catching fish, and it's about your attitude changing their attitude.
Yeah, definitely. You have to, and as I mentioned before, you have to kind of tailor your guiding style to the people you're guiding.
Yes.
It came into play. I saw it in some guides we had a couple of weeks ago. We floated the Grand Ronde with a buddy who doesn't have as much fly fishing experience as I do, but he's a good fly fisherman. And we had a young guide. He was like 27 years old, and he was perfect. I mean, he gave me a little bit of, okay, cast it there or try to do this. But my friend, he gave more because he needed more, and
right,
in a way that didn't make you feel dumb.
Yeah.
And you feel like, oh, okay, I'm learning something here, and this is how you catch fish. And we did. We caught a ton of fish. So it worked out really well. And that's how I kind of tried to do my own guiding career also. You know, I don't do it anymore. I haven't done it for about two seasons now. But that's kind of what I did. And I am actually a professionally trained instructor too. So it gave me some skills when I was at the National Laboratory. I was teaching people how to use radiation detection equipment, which is a whole nother life there.
Wow.
It helped me guide a little bit better too, because I could take some of the skills I learned as an instructor in a classroom and doing practical exercises with the equipment and just take that out, export that out onto the river and teach people about fly fishing. So it really worked really well.
Yeah. I feel like as a fly fishing, there's so much to learn about fly fishing, which in the very beginning, when you start to learn to fly fish, it's a little intimidating. There's so many components. There's fly, there's floating line, non-floating line. I mean, you can probably rack your head around fly fishing, you know, when you first go into it. You know, it's not like, oh, I just want to go fishing. You're like, well, or what kind of tippet are you using? What weight are you using? You're like, this is overwhelming. What bug am I using? Like, there's so many things going against you. But when you do catch that fish, and especially when you put somebody else on fish based on your recommendations, mm-hmm. I think that's one of the most rewarding feelings is when it all comes together.
It is. Yeah, definitely. And it's also one of the most scary and terrifying feelings when you're not doing that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Thing right. Except we're not catching fish. You know, why is that? So, I mean, it is very rewarding and it's fun. You know, I enjoyed it.
And a most humbling experience, I'm sure.
Yeah. I've had friends tell me I could never be a guide. You know, I don't want to put up with all that stuff that people have and trying to teach them and, you know, not fishing yourself and things. It's like, well, it's a different kind of a mindset and a different skill set to be able to do that well, I think.
You know what I always get nervous about, like being a guide, is that you're also responsible for those people on your boat, like their lives. Actually, just recently, I was reading the Missoulian. I think this happened last week, but someone had the boat capsize on the Clark Fork, and everybody fell in the water, which you think because it's fall, the water levels are low. They were in a certain area where there was enough waves that, and so they had to like life flight these people to receive help. So I hope they're okay. I should probably do a backup and make sure they're okay. But I mean, that's why I think it'd be so great for you, because you're always you were responsible as a Coast Guard for other people's lives and make sure that they were safe. And so I think that is the big thing for me, is that when you have people on your boat, you're responsible to make sure that they're safe and they go home and make sure that there's no lightning storm that's going to come and maybe exactly. Send them not back to their house.
Right.
Fun adventure can go sideways quickly.
Yeah, definitely. That's you're exactly right there. And you know, the first guide job I had with Greg Price at Deschutes River Outfitters, he said to me before I started guiding, he said, here's our motto or creed or whatever you want to call it. He said, safe, fun, fish, in that order. And, you know, you want to make sure everything's safe. You want to make sure they're having fun. And then if you happen to catch fish in addition to all that, then great, you know, but those two are the most important, you know, definitely.
Yeah. Like you said, I mean, a fun day, you think you're going to just go in there and do an activity, but there's so many other things that can possibly go wrong. Kind of reminds me of Jeff Perrin's story about losing your boat. I mean, just because you're going to do activity doesn't mean it's always going to pan out the way that you think it is.
Yeah, exactly.
You're still going out in nature, and boats are in water, and water, you know, is sometimes can be unpredictable, but that's why you hire a guide.
Yeah.
What does your fishing life look now that you're retired? So are you just, cause I mean, I have seen some amazing pictures. You've traveled the world. Like what is your fly fishing life looking like these days?
Well, it's really good. Yeah, and big shout out to my wife, Susan, for allowing me to go on these things and being a good supporter of my, my hobbies. My life is pretty much golf and fishing. And we live in Eagle Crest. We have 3 golf courses and I play a lot of golf. Plus I go fishing quite a bit. I probably fish over 100 days a year. And it's, you know, it's my lifelong passion and I do it a lot. So yeah, but, so Ron and I are going fishing in Chile in January.
Good for you.
Thank you. And then the following December, we're trying to get to New Zealand.
Bucket list.
Those are bucket list trips for me. Definitely. Last year and a year ago, January, Ron and I went to Jurassic Lake, which was one of those pictures I sent in that big rainbow. And that was amazing. If you do a YouTube search of Jurassic Lake and look at those videos, that's what it's like. It's not hype. It's all true. So it's amazing.
And they don't call it Jurassic for nothing.
No, there's huge rainbows in that lake. Yeah. They catch them over 20 pounds every week when people are in there pretty much.
What's your go-to fly when you were out on Jurassic, when you caught that nice fish?
That fish, let me see. Pretty sure I caught that one on Mr. Good Old Woolly Bugger, you know, but
that Woolly Bugger is a go-to bug, I feel like.
Yeah, it's
for a lot of people.
Yeah, it suggests so many different things that fish eat. You know, when they look at it, they see either a dragonfly nymph or a minnow or a leech or who knows what else, but all they know is, boy, that looks like something good that I ate before, and they chomp it.
Well, and I was going to say, because you do have this great, amazing career of fly fishing, what do you think you want people who are going into fly fishing, what's the biggest thing that you want people to go into as they start to go on their journey of fly fishing?
Yeah, so one of the big things definitely is don't get frustrated with everything fly fishing. You know, like you mentioned, it can be so technical and involved and, you know, confusing, you know, when you're looking at all the different things. Just go into it and have fun. You know, if you like tying your own flies, you know, take a lesson or something and tie your own flies. If you don't, then buy some flies that you think are going to work. You know, there's such an amazing wealth of knowledge and information out on the internet these days. You can figure out pretty much anything you want to. If you want to learn how to Euro nymph, you can go on, look on a YouTube video. If you want to learn how to tie a woolly bugger, there's YouTube videos for that too. I mean, everything pretty much you can figure out. So just, you know, go into it thinking you're going to have fun. You don't know it all quite yet, but your quest will take you further and further. Like I said, I've been doing it over 50 years. I don't know everything yet. I learn something every time I go out there. And that's one of the reasons I love it so much, is because it's a never ending journey of discovery and learning for me, big time.
What do you think is the first, what's the last thing you just learned about fly fishing that took you 50 years just to learn right now?
Well, on the 2 trips I was on a couple weeks back, one was on the Upper Columbia River up near Canada, where it's a huge river, you know, and we were using, at one point we were using stonefly nymphs, but the guide thought they looked like October caddis, cased caddis nymphs. And we caught fish on. And the same thing when we floated the Grand Ronde, it was a big, good old stonefly nymph called, I think I've heard it called the girdle bug, and also Pat's rubber legs. And it's probably one of the easiest flies to tie. However, to me, productive. It looks really a lot like a stonefly nymph. And I just learned, hey, fish might take it for caged October caddis too. We caught a ton of fish. We caught over 200 fish in one day between the four of us in the two rafts on the Grand Ronde. So, I mean, and most of us were using that nymph. So, I mean, it's just amazing how good it is. So I learned that. Yeah.
That's always, see, and that's how I feel about fly fishing. I mean, I still have so much to learn. I think I'm trying to do this NAPTE. I'm like, I think I've got it figured out, Justin. And he went out there. He's like, yeah, you've got a lot more to learn. I'm like, okay, well, moving forward, but I keep my chin up. I mean, I love it. I think that's what makes fly fishing so much fun is that there's always more fish out there that have different techniques in catching them and more skill levels. And but yeah, I think what I like to think is that anyone can fly fish, and you don't need to feel that the only reason why you can't fly fish is you're not an expert. You know, everyone starts from the beginning at some point. I mean, like Ron Kay, he started much later in life. And so I think it's always so great that it's like, you don't have to be an expert to go out there and have fun. I mean, even if you do put the wrong tippet on there, like just go out there and go fishing. Yeah. You'll learn. Yeah. Well, like I said, I know you said in the very beginning, you had another fishing story for us. So I think you said it was about Justin. So I'd love to hear it.
Yeah. So it has to do with fishing. It's not a fishing story, but my first year of guiding, and I was going down the Deschutes River with two clients, and I really like to take off the river at dark. You know, I like to fish till dark, and then you're rowing out in the dark. You can well enough to get your way down the river. So anyway, I get into the boat ramp, and there was one other boat ahead of me that were just taken out also. And they were getting their stuff ready. So I get in there, and I walk up to the parking lot, and no truck. So I'm looking around, I can't find it. So I talk to these two guys who are getting their boat ready, and I say, geez, you know what, I can't find my truck. So they say, well, are you sure they brought it down here, you know, from the put-in up at Warm Springs? So we're taken out at Trout Creek. And I said, well, I think so. And at that time, this was, you know, 2001, and I don't think you had very good cell or any cell coverage down at Trout Creek. Now you do, but then it was pretty bad. So they said, well, geez, we could give you a ride back to the boat launch if you want. I said, well, great. That'd be super. So I told my two clients, hang tight here. I'm going to go get my truck and come back. So they gave me a lift to the boat ramp. Well, we get to the boat ramp and there's nothing there. So, so this other guy, the guy who was driving, who was your husband, Justin, he says,
what?
Did you check the other parking lot? And I said, what other parking lot? Like I said, that was my first year there. I had never seen the other parking lot and it was dark. So anyway, they drive me back to the boat, to Trout Creek. Sure enough, my truck and trailer were in the upper parking lot, because it was during salmon fly season. It was really busy, you know, a zillion rigs parked down there. So Justin saved my bacon, and I do dearly appreciate that. And I told him that when we fly fish together, and he remembered that too.
But so when you saw Justin, you didn't know he was the one that saved you. Were you in the car like, hey, wait a second, you helped me out this many years ago, like, because you recognized his face? Or,
you know,
did you just remember his name forever and thinking like, one day I'm going to cross paths with him again?
It was kind of in the back of my mind that this was the guy that helped me out. You know, I can't remember exactly when the light bulb went on, but it was definitely is like, are you the guy that did the, you know, he said, I seem to remember that. Yeah. Okay, cool.
What a small world. Yeah. The fly fishing community is pretty small. I feel like there's always somebody who I'm talking to and like maybe 1 degree to, you know, what did they say? The 45 degrees with Kevin Bacon or something like that. But with fly fishing, I think you can know somebody that you've talked to. You're like, oh, I know that person. Like, oh yeah, I fished with them. I know who you're talking about. But no, what a small world. I love that. So Tim, if anybody wants to kind of follow your journeys, like what's the best way for them to, keep in touch with you?
You know, I always say that I'm keeping my cyber footprint small. I'm not on Instagram or Facebook or anything like that. I am, however, the president of the largest fly fishing club in Oregon, the Central Oregon Fly Fishers here in Bend.
Oh, wonderful.
You can reach me through them. I've been the president for almost 2 years now, and might be next year, might not be, who knows. We'll see if anybody steps up. But it's a great organization. We do all kinds of cool things for the members. We do, of course, it's been tough this last year and a half, almost every
right.
The president because of COVID, but hopefully this next year we'll be getting back into in-person meetings and being able to do more things together. We also do a lot of cool things for the local community. We teach kids about fishing in general, fly fishing specifically, and we help with cleanups on the Crooked River. We do a lot of cool things. So, I mean, if you live in Central Oregon and you have any interest in fly fishing, check us out. Coflyfishers.org, I think, is our website. And just a great bunch of people in the club. It's fun. Yeah, we do a lot of things.
I think that's great. Well, maybe when I make my way out back to Bend, I'll have to come swing by this organization. Maybe you guys have some kind of event going on, and we can go fishing too and hit the Deschutes.
Oh, you bet. Yeah, that would be great.
Thanks for listening. Next week, we will be at Elk Camp trying to fill our freezers with tasty wild protein.
So that means no new episode next Tuesday. But speaking of tasty protein, why don't you circle back around and listen to our conversation with Meat Eater fishing editor Sam Lundgren in episode 56.
Come on, Justin, grab your pack.
Yep, grab yours. It's the big one.
Go to thefebruaryroom.com where you can access a complete library of our podcast and read more about our guest, their fishing stories, and favorite fly patterns. We're always looking for exceptional fly fishing yarns, and if you have one to spin, shoot us an email at info@thefebruaryroom.com. The February Room is always free, but if you feel like throwing a nickel in the pond, we appreciate any additional listener support. For companies and individuals interested in sponsorship opportunities, please contact us for our media kit. Thanks for stopping by the February Room, and we'll see you down here next week.